it seems to me that a lot of people start their relationships in our culture today based on chemistry, a very early physical involvement, and they miss out on just friendship. And then, for some couples, as they are married for quite a few years, that intense sexual frenzy that they started their marriage with wanes. Maybe not for any of you, but we've counseled some couples that, and so if that's what sort of, they got caught up in that and didn't develop a friendship, and then that area of the relationship is starting not to be quite as intense, and they never had a friendship, they're together, but there's nothing that's sort of keeping them together as a couple. So tonight we're going to talk about eight areas of friendship, I think. I'm having a hard time with my numbers this week, but I think it is eight, or let's say seven. We're going to do seven. Seven areas. So, are there eight on the page? Oh, there are eight. Grow old and enjoy. That's good. I was right. Eight. There are eight. Good. Let me pray for us. We'll get started. Father, thanks for a great day, just for the privilege of being with people who love our families and have a desire to have families that honor you and honor each other. And we pray tonight you'll help us as we talk a little bit about this area of friendship in marriage. Christ's name. Amen. First area is to study, to continue to be a student of your spouse. In 1 Peter 3:7, we're told, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as a weaker partner, as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. The version you have in your outline says to live with your wives in an understanding way. And the question here, just very simple, is if you're going to be a friend to your spouse, how well do you know your spouse? Do you know your spouse early in marriage? You probably were a little more intentional about knowing them than you are now.
As most of you know, our youngest daughter, Julie, got married in August, just this past August, and we've been just impressed in watching their relationship grow over the last 3 years and now almost 1 year of marriage, that it comes very naturally for them to want to know each other, to pay attention to what they're saying, to act on what they're hearing. We don't have to remind them of that. They don't have to remind each other. It just comes really naturally. And we're guessing that for most of you, if you think back in time to the beginning of your relationship, it probably came really naturally for you as well. It certainly did for us.
Our middle daughter was dating somebody, had just dated for a few weeks before Christmas, and so she wasn't sure. He was coming over for a Christmas dinner, and she wasn't sure if she should have a present for him, because they really weren't that far along in the relationship. But what if he brought a present and she didn't have one? So she had one and left it in her room in case he had one, then she had one. So she was covering the bases, and sure enough, he comes with a present. And so we said, well, sweetie, what was it? And she said, he got me an onion chopper. That was exactly my reaction. It's sort of like, cut your loss quick. You know, any guy who gives you an onion chopper is worth chopping, you know. But we have grown as parents to see our daughter's face, and she didn't seem upset. And she seemed kind of happy. She said, well, what is it? And she said, well, I was making dinner for our FCA group, and he came over just before dinner, and I was cutting onions, and I was crying. And I said, I hate cutting onions. I said, that's a good guy.
You can probably come up with stories of your own on this, but one that's especially clear to me in our relationship, Paul and I met in San Diego, who's on InterVarsity staff. I was still a student, but we were not at the same schools when we started getting to know each other and becoming really, really, really good friends. And then came the time that I received this typewritten invitation in the mail. Now, some of you need to Google typewriter when you leave here, probably, but it's how we used to communicate, sort of like. And anyway, this typewritten letter came, inviting me to go to the finest restaurant in San Diego with the finest company, and gave me the time and the date, said when he'd pick me up at my parents' house, which is where I was still living. So he came, and we were both dressed to the nines. By 1974 standards. And just before Paul opened the door for me to get into his 1955 Ford station wagon, which was old even then, he said, there's just one thing I want to do. He said, I'd like to blindfold you because I don't want you to see where we're going. Now, especially for you college students, I do not recommend that you let your date blindfold you, unless you know them really, really well. And I felt we knew each other very well, and I trusted him, so I said, sure, why not? So off we went in the car, making only one stop en route to the final destination. Pulled in front of his, now I know, apartment, and he said, I just have to run in and get something that I forgot, which I actually should have paid more attention to. That was clearly a harbinger of things to come. Well, we eventually get to our final destination, and still blindfolded, I could hear Paul getting things out of the car, and I had no idea where we were or what he was doing. But pretty soon, he said, he came and he opened my door, still keep the blindfold on, I'll guide you to the restaurant. And finally, we got somewhere, he took off the blindfold, and we were standing on Sunset Cliffs in North San Diego, overlooking the Pacific Ocean, just about a half an hour before sunset. Before me was a table set, card table, candle, two place settings, two chairs, and the forgotten item, a cassette tape player, which was crooning with the music of the Carpenters. Our favorite. He served up the first course, which was salad, and he said, before you take your first bite, I just need to tell you something. He said, I heard you say that you love avocados. I've never bought an avocado, so I didn't know if it was supposed to be hard or soft or whatever, so I went to the market and I got one. And I'll just say in advance, if it's not good, I'm really, really sorry. Well, upon taking the first bite, it was clear he did not know how to pick an avocado. It was hard and it was tasteless, and it didn't matter. I actually felt so loved by this expression of his that he had listened, he had paid attention, he had cataloged that information, and then he had acted on it. And as we have thought about this subject of friendship and marriage, part of the reason at that moment in time that I extended grace rather than judgment, where I extended appreciation rather than criticism, was because we were in the flush of this amazing, budding love and appreciation for who each other was and for the heart behind the gesture. And we're just going to suggest tonight that that comes pretty naturally early in our relationships, but it's much harder for us to continue to sustain through our marriages. And I would like to say to you that in each of the avocado moments, as we've dubbed them, of our life together, I haven't always responded with such grace and with such kindness and with such appreciation as I did that night. But if our friendship in marriage is going to continue to thrive and support ultimately the goal of marriage, which is to reflect the glory of God, we really are going to have to choose to continue to extend grace and kindness in those moments, even when we're disappointed.
The first question is, how well do we know each other? We have a friend who has a wallet. In his wallet, he has his wife's shoe size, dress size, favorite color, favorite flower, favorite foods. He says, it's just helpful for me. When I hear her say something, I just jot it down. And so I have an opportunity. And what that's saying is, I know you, I love you, I want to meet who you are. It doesn't happen very often, but I will say one of the most hurtful things Virginia will say to me, and she doesn't say it intending to hurt, but she says, don't you even know me? She said, we've been married for 36 years. Don't you know me when I do something or don't do something? And I think we're just, it's a challenge to all of us to keep being a student of our spouse. Keep learning what's new to them, what they appreciate, so that we can serve them. The second thing is a response to that. Do something. Act on those things that you know are important to your spouse. John 13:15 says, now that you know these things, this is after Jesus washed the disciples' feet, says, now that you know these things, you will be blessed. And then there are those last words, if you do them. In fact, it's worse when you know and your spouse knows you know what they want and you don't do it. So the blessing comes from knowing and then acting on that. We were meeting with a couple, and the wife said, I just have never really felt cherished by my husband. And we said, well, give us an example. And she said, well, we've been married for 35 years, and he has never been there for my birthday once. And he's a doctor, and he says, I'm a doctor. And she said, he always gets a call. He always says he has to stay late. Now, that happens with all of us at times, you know, something comes up. You know, a birthday is the same day every year. Do you know that? So, like, for 35 years, his wife's birthday was on the same day. Now, he failed. Because to say, oh, I'm sorry, I missed it, that's not good. You can't do that for 35 years. What it's saying is, you know, that's, you're not that important to me. So it's not knowing, but doing it as well. We had a couple here this last week who this story is about. They let us use it with permission. Some of you may have even heard it before, but Lou and Grace Charette, they were here on our staff. They had been married for 30 years when they came to our staff, and we were in a room with them when Lou told Grace for the first time in her hearing that he says, I've never loved you for 30 years. A little awkward to be in the room when he told her for the first time. And they split after that. Didn't go well, didn't go down well. And so he left the island, she stayed here. They were apart for a year and a half. From a human standpoint, they never should have been married. Lou grew up being shipped from orphanage to orphanage, foster home, a rough and tough, very angry young man. Anything dirty, anything mechanical. He was a heavy equipment operator, diesel mechanic, loved drag races, rodeos, all that. Grace was Dutch, and she liked tea parties. She liked quilting. She liked craft shows. And so they got back together, though. It's another story, but after a year and a half, they were back together. We were with them in Boston at the Nutcracker Ballet, and at intermission, I went up to Lou, and I said, so Lou, you like ballet, huh? And he looked me straight in the eye and he says, I love my wife. And that's the right answer. I mean, he thought about the ballet like our daughter Julie when he said, how'd you like the Nutcracker? He said, it was okay except for the dancing. But you see, Lou goes to ballet and craft shows and quilt shows, and Grace goes to drag races and rodeos. Not because they like it, but because they love each other. Now, not all the time. But see, love is that response to knowing this is important to my spouse. And so one of them says, it would mean a lot to me if you would go. They say, I'll go.
I thought it was really interesting this fall as Tim Tebow made his huge splash on the national stage of the NFL and captured our hearts, really, especially those of us who really were thrilled to see a professional athlete who was so bold about his faith. But I read something that came across the internet. It was entitled, Why I Watch Football. And it was written by a woman who began the article saying, my husband is a football fanatic. He loves football. We've been married for 17 years, and for 17 years he's asked me to watch football with him, and for 17 years I have resolutely denied him. I just told him, I don't like football. I don't want to waste my Sunday afternoons that way. That's just ridiculous. Why would I ever want to do that? And she said, and then came Tim Tebow. And she said, I now don't miss a game where I have an opportunity to watch Tim Tebow play. And I actually felt really sad when I read that article, because I actually thought about her husband. And I thought to myself, so she could be motivated to watch Tim
Tebow play football, but nothing else in 17 years of her husband's desire for her to spend a Sunday afternoon with him watching football motivated her. And it actually just made me ask the question of myself, and I'm going to challenge you each to consider, what lengths are you willing to go to not only know what's important to your mate, but to actually act on what you know? Or is it just so easy to excuse ourselves for the things that would be meaningful to our mate, but that would be compelling to us if someone other than our mate felt that that was either important or captivating to do?
We were with Gabe and Carrie, and they're staying right now with Gabe's parents. And we wanted to thank them for allowing us to stay with them, Gabe's parents. And so we were at Costco, the best store in the world. And and I said, Gabe, would your mom like some flowers? That we would bring her flowers when we came. And he said, she would love that. Now, if you said that for Carrie, she would not appreciate it at all. But my mom would. Carrie does not like cut flowers, thinks it's a waste of money. But my mom loves cut flowers. And I thought, wow, I have got a very smart son-in-law that in 5 years of marriage knows don't buy flowers. Because even though he may be told that's what every woman wants, not Carrie. Because not Carrie is not every woman. That's for sure. Carrie is his wife, and he knows her. Thirdly, so know, act, and third, be intentional in pursuing common focus. Matthew 19, 5 and 6 says, the two become one, they are no longer two. This image of oneness in marriage is just permeates everything that is taught about marriage. The two become one, the two become one. It's not the three that become one, it's not the four that become one. We're at a family camp, we like kids, we had kids, we think you should take care of them, but they can really do damage to marriages. And sometimes when we're diagramming this, we'll do three circles. There's a circle of a husband, circle of a wife, and then a circle of children. And even physically, when you try to often hug each other's husband and wife, the little booger gets in between you, right? So right from the start, they're trying to separate you, right? So that's just sort of, but they're what hold many couples together. Everything we talk about is the kids. When we vacation, it's always with the kids. We do it with the kids, with the kids. And then the kids drop out. And what's happening? You've got two circles that are hanging with nothing connecting them. And so what I want to say here is be committed to pursuing common interests and keeping those interests alive.
And we're going to guess again, if you think back into your relationship, especially at the beginning, there must have been things that you had in common that drew you together. And for many of us in marriage, life interrupts those things that we once held in common, and we're busy, and we're pressed, and we're financially challenged, and some of us can be physically challenged, and there are all sorts of things that can interrupt the places that we had of connection. In a marriage that thrives and is going to make it for the long haul, reflecting the glory of God, we're going to have to be very intentional about continuing to pursue common interests, places that draw us together. Those will likely change over time. But let's not give up. Just because the things that once worked no longer work, I think many of us in our marriages just kind of become lazy about marriage. Not lazy about life. Oh, we've got lots of things that prove that we're not lazy about life, but we can become very lazy about our marriages and not continue to pursue things that will cause us to come together.
So if you say, you know, well, boy, when we got married, we both liked doing this, we both liked doing that, and we're for some reason not able to anymore, that's not an interest, don't let it sit there. We just want to challenge you to say, well, what can we do together? Because this is not healthy to say, you know, you just do what you want to do, and I'll do what I want to do. You like climbing and hiking, you go with your friends. I like the theater, I'll go with my friends. That seems so mature. And it is just often that which starts taking us along in parallel lives. And not always, but one of the dangers is all of a sudden, these people who enjoy hiking, you start enjoying being with. Because they have something you really like doing. And they say, your husband doesn't enjoy hiking? That must be so hard. Oh, it is. Well, tell me about it. And you start talking about how hard it is to live with your husband. And it seems really nice to walk with this man. And same on the theater or museum side. Make sure that you're doing those things that are bringing you together, not taking you apart. Fourthly, be committed to the covenant relationship more than circumstances. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves, what are those next three words? At all times, and a brother is born for adversity. She's not fun anymore. We were counseling a couple, and he said, I don't know, man. I don't know if I want to stay married. She's just not fun. I mean, she used to go out drinking with me all the time. I mean, every weekend we're drinking and partying, and she says, we've got three kids. Grow up. But he says, but you're not fun. Well, you see, he's ready to leave because circumstances have changed. And we need to really, friends are those people that stay together when circumstances change.
And I'm really thrilled that we have our college students here tonight, because those of us who have already made the marriage commitment, this is the given. The call of God to us in marriage is that we respect the covenant. It's a for keeps relationship that we make when we enter this covenant. But we have students who are coming to our Engagement Matters weekends who are in their early to mid-20s, thinking about marriage pretty seriously or already engaged. And what has become very clear to us over these last few years is that the message of our culture has been so pervasive that marriage is a convenience relationship, that it's a contractual relationship, but that it's not a covenant relationship, that we've really lost sight of the global view of marriage. We had a woman at our last Engagement Matters, she and her boyfriend, were they engaged at that point? Maybe.
What are you talking about? So keep going.
We were explaining the very nature of the covenant, and she was not a believer, nor was he.
Actually. She was very, very vivacious, expressive woman, and we're teaching on this. And I said, like when you marry, this is for life. And she said, well, yeah, but what if you don't like each other anymore? I mean, what if, you sort of lose that love and feeling? I said, it's for life. She goes, whoa! And she just throws her hands up and says, I've never heard that before. I said, you mean you're supposed to stay married even if you don't really enjoy each other? We said, well, that's not the goal of being miserable. And God can do miraculous things. But yes, it is a covenantal relationship. We met with a couple who came in to talk to us. And he pretty much wanted out of the marriage and felt he had every reason to leave the marriage. Because he said his wife obviously was not acting in a loving way to him, didn't seem to love him anymore. And we said, well, give us sort of the story. He said, well, she won't have sex with me every other day like she's supposed to. And she won't do everything sexually that I want her to. And if she loved me, she would. So she obviously doesn't love me, so I really shouldn't have to stay with her. Because I shouldn't live my life deprived because of having a wife like this. I gave him a few thoughts that I had. He actually got up. He was not happy. But then 3 days later, we got an email from another gentleman. And we had spoken in Northern California on marriage at a church. And afterwards, a gentleman came up and he said, what you said was so helpful. I agree with everything you said. But he said, I don't know if you've come across this, but he says, my wife is mentally ill. And she has such bouts with depression that she is incapable of doing what you said. So where you were talking about both serving and caring, she's incapable of giving back. So what do you do in a situation like that? And Virginia thought of something really good, which is sort of the pattern in our marriage. And she said, you know, why don't we write these two people who we knew both had had this situation in their marriage and see if they would give us any input. And I want to read just a portion of an incredible email from one of them. And he'd been married for 35 years to a woman, been in and out of mental institutions, severe depression for most of their marriage. And this is what he said. And what God has called together, he doesn't want broken. I would be lying if I said that the word divorce never entered my mind, but it never really entered my thinking. Vows are vows. In the dark night, sometimes our thoughts go to the idea that we might be better off if only we could flee the marriage. But in the morning, standing and staying is of God. And by staying, you have honored God in ways perhaps more noble and glorious than any of the Christian leaders that you might deeply admire. Honoring your vow is a deep thing that God has asked of you and placed upon you, and by honoring it, in your own small way, you have been helping God's kingdom come to life here on earth, because a vow has been kept in a world that treats vows like tissue paper, easily shredded and torn. Kept vows build God's shalom like very little else does. There's an old story of an older missionary couple that came back to the States on a steamship after a long and faithful career serving invisibly and without much reward overseas. They were at the rail of the ship as it came to its berth, and there was much fanfare and commotion there on the dock to greet a famous dignitary who was on the ship with them coming home. The old man mumbled something to his wife about how they weren't getting any kind of a welcoming or recognition. His wife paused a moment and then said, "But honey, we're not home yet." One day you'll look Jesus in the eye and he will know what you have done, and he will look in your eyes and whisper, "Well done." Not perfectly done. Lord knows how imperfectly I've handled this calling he has put upon me and the things I am ashamed of and the failures that I know and carry. But one day you'll be home and all the things will be made right. One day, so keep hoping. This world is not all there is. This world is upside down. But one day, your wife will be fully alive, and so will you. One day, so keep hoping. As you live in the messiness of the present, keep hoping for the wonder of the future. It is beyond what you can imagine, so keep hoping. The contrast of that was just so incredible. Here's one man ready to leave his wife because she won't have sex every other day with him. And another man's whose wife has probably not responded to him for years at a time. And he says, "But I made a vow." It's a covenant relationship. Friends stay together, and we're called to be lovers and friends. Fifthly, be honest. Friends are honest with each other. They're truthful with each other. They don't have secrets.
And this is a really, really important commitment that we make when we enter the covenant relationship, and that is to continue the pursuit and the commitment to honesty in our marriages. It's very easy to let this one slip. And it's very easy to let it slip actually before we enter the covenant relationship. At our Engagement Matters weekends, one of the sessions we do includes a whole section on honesty and truth-telling in the context of our deepest desire and need is for true intimacy that can really only be experienced in the marriage relationship. Marriage, being a reflection of the Godhead, has the potential for allowing us the experience of unity with another person unlike any other relationship we have on earth. That is part of the design. So we long for that intimacy, which is the reason that we continue to get married in a world that's surrounded by crash and burn marriages, statistics that are very dismal. And for many of us in our own extended family networks and our friends and community around us, we don't see a whole lot of positive advertisement for marriage. But we keep getting married. The wedding industry is not lacking for brides and grooms. And that's because we were designed for the intimacy that marriage potentially holds for us. But the part we often overlook is that in order to experience that kind of intimacy, we have to be absolutely committed to honesty and transparency. We will really only experience intimacy to the degree that we are honest and transparent with one another. It's a relationship in which we can be fully known and fully loved.
that's what we long for. But if we're not really committed to that, the intimacy we experience will be greatly compromised, and in the end, marriage once again gets a really bad rap. It just didn't really deliver. We had a couple at one of our engagement matters who, after this session, sent us an email several days later, and she said, that night that we talked about honesty and truthfulness and intimacy and all of that, she said, I just had this sinking feeling the whole time that talk was going on. Because we're engaged, our wedding date is 3 months from now, and there were some pretty big things that I had not told my fiance. She said, I completely rationalized it in my own thinking because I'd already put those at the foot of the cross. I knew that God had forgiven me. I knew I wasn't really that person anymore. And so why would he have to know that? It would only hurt him to know it, which is one of the enemy's great, great lies in this area. And everything she had said was true. She had been forgiven. It had been placed at the foot of the cross. God didn't hold that sin against her. As far as the east was from the west, her sin was removed from her. But when you are entering the most intimate relationship you will ever enter on earth, you can't hide what you don't want the other person to know if you hope to ever experience that intimacy. So she said, by the end of the session, I knew that I had to tell him. And one of the things we say in that session is, in coming forth with something, you realize that it potentially could end your relationship. The other person now has information that they need to have, and they could decide that they don't want to continue ahead. But better to find that out this side of the altar than the other, because the truth is that all of those deeds of the darkness eventually make their way into the light. So it's at some point in life, it is going to come out. She said, so that night, I said to him, I've got some things that I need to tell you. And she said, by now I'm crying. And she said, there are things that I'm very ashamed of and that I was really hoping to never have to tell you, but I really feel like God has convicted me that I need to do this. So she said, after I confessed to him the things that I was hiding from him, I looked up and he was crying. And he said, well, there are actually a few things that I need to tell you also. And she said they had this amazing experience of being able to extend forgiveness to one another, to know that now they really were not hiding anything, so they'd put them in a position of being fully known, and they both made the decision that they wanted to continue ahead in their relationship. They're now 15 years into their marriage. They have 3 kids that they're raising for Christ, and God is doing a great, great work through their lives together. But she said, I met with her just before I came out this summer, and she said, I'm just telling you, I am more convinced than ever that our marriage would never have unfolded the way that it has if I had gone down the aisle knowing that I had knowingly deceived him by not telling him what I didn't want him to know. And that's an ongoing commitment that we really need to have in our marriages, because the enemy is going to want to divide us, and he's very clever in doing so. We can justify, we can rationalize, we've had more people sit in our office, well, I didn't want to tell her because I think it was okay for me to have lied because it would have hurt her. Well, the hurt actually isn't in the telling. The hurt is in what you have done. So the telling of it only gets it out into the open. It doesn't change what has already happened. So this one can be a tough one, because I think we live in a culture that has sanctioned lying and encourages dishonesty. And if it's more convenient to do it that way, it's less embarrassing. We consider it inconsequential anyway. There are a million ways that dishonesty can slip into our relationship, but we will just tell you, as Tim said this morning, there's a cost that comes with it. It costs. And the place we don't want to have to pay in the marriage relationship is with the genuine intimacy that we long for.
Sixthly, practice affirmation. Be an encourager. If you want a friendship to keep growing, we need to encourage each other. Hebrews 3:13 says, but encourage one another daily. How often? Daily. Wow, that's like every day, right? Okay. So encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today. It's like every day, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. We need to encourage each other. We certainly need to encourage each other in God's word. We need to encourage each other in what God is doing in our lives. I know a lot of men who say, I married a cheerleader and then found out that I got a critic. And before we were married, she thought I was wonderful. And after I got married, she decided she could really make me better. We need to know how to encourage each other in this. And the next point, we'll take the other side of this. But this point is just to hang on it. We need to be intentional about how to encourage each other. And I don't know what it is. In marriage, often we think that we can really inspire our spouse to be better if we just keep being negative about them. Tell them what's wrong with them. Just keep nagging that booger, he'll change. You know, I don't know, men don't seem to respond that. I don't go, you know, if you nag me more, I'll do whatever you want. It's no way. There's something else that digs our heels in. And, you know, our children don't do that, don't do well. If we want to motivate our children, do we want to keep telling them how wrong they are? Just make sure they know they're a failure. Boy, that is so motivational to children. You know, no, we want to encourage them. Look for ways to encourage them, who they are and their uniqueness. If we're a parent who loves our children, we're looking for things they do well and just focusing on that. And as husband and wife, so important that we practice encouragement.
Some who have studied marriage say that for most of us, we probably like about 80% of what's in our mate, and 20% we're hoping will improve over time, and that many of us spend most of our time focusing on the 20%, and as a result, that side actually grows. I've had more women in my office who are very unhappy with their husbands, and the first time I will ask them the question, well, tell me a little bit about why you married him in the first place. They look blank initially, but given just a few moments even, they begin to get in touch with things that they really, really do genuinely love and respect about their husband. They're surprised at the list that they can come up with, and often the takeaway for them is, oh my goodness, I kind of have forgotten about those things because I'm so focused on this thing. I'm so upset about this area of disappointment or disillusionment. It can be an area of sin. And I'm not in any way suggesting that we just overlook the areas of sin. I think that we'll get to it in the next point, that part of our covenant privilege is encouraging growth in one another. But notice that it comes after the point of encouraging one another, of affirming one another. Make sure that your 20% doesn't overwhelm the 80%.
You know, it's maybe too strong of a statement, but I don't think there is anything wrong with me that Virginia hasn't told me is wrong with me. Well, like I said, I don't want to be dogmatic about this. I pretty much know. It's not like, oh yeah, well, I forgot that that's wrong with me. Man, thanks for reminding me every day that that's an area I fail in. I know. And we don't usually say, oh, I just want to tell you, I really feel bad how much failure I am. But we know the areas we're failing in. We really don't need somebody to every day tell us we're failing. I don't know anybody who finds that motivating. So encourage one another daily. Don't critique one another daily. Encourage one another daily. Then, now we go to, well, if you just encourage them, how are you going to ever help them grow? Well, Proverbs 27:17, speaking to brothers here, but it certainly applies to marriage. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. We had some friends, and I asked them once, been married for about 6 years, I said, how do you help your wife grow when you're aware of something that she is failing in? He says, oh, I never tell her. I said, well, yeah, but I mean, if there's an area that she may not be aware of that she's needs growth in, how do you tell her? Oh, I don't, because that would upset her. And I don't want to upset her. And I said, wow, it's too bad. I bet she's becoming pretty rusty, huh? Your wife's probably not very sharp anymore. What's this say? as iron, what? Sharpens iron. See, there's nobody that knows me better than Virginia. And there's nobody that knows Virginia better than me. And so we have the possibility of sharpening each other or stabbing each other with that same knowledge. We can help each other grow, or we can use that weakness, that area, against each other. And that's the challenge we have. For us, a barometer to how well our marriage is doing is how well we take criticism from each other. When I am convinced that Virginia's for me and we're doing really well, she can talk about me not flossing my teeth and, you know, areas that I fail in. Oh, thanks. Sorry. But when we're not doing well, why are you always picking on me? What's the difference? One, I'm convinced she's for me. One, I feel she's against me. I don't know if any of you know this person, but he's the greatest quarterback that's ever lived, Tom Brady. And I've told this story, and actually I confirmed it last week with him. I talked to him about this. Some of you may know this, that when Tom was in eighth grade, he had a coach named Thomas Martinez. And from that point on, Thomas Martinez taught Tom Brady how to pass. And every game from that point on that Thomas Martinez saw, he would call Tom Brady and critique him. And Thomas Martinez died just a couple months ago. But all through his NFL career, after every game, phone would ring, Thomas Martinez. Tom, this is what you did wrong. And so I asked him at the wedding last Sunday night. I said, is this true? And he said, yes, it's true. And I said, and did you welcome every call? And he said, yes. And I said, well, the point I make in marriage is you welcomed every call because you knew Thomas Martinez loved you, he wanted you to do better, and he was for you. You know, folks, I want to say that same in marriage. We welcome a call from our spouse if we know they're for us. But unfortunately, most of us are thinking it's just somebody who's trying to stab us, be critical of us, hurt us. But when Thomas Martinez called, Tom Brady answered the phone and liked it. That's a challenge we have. The last point is grow old and enjoy the memories together as friends. We have some friends that we have spoken of previous years, Claude and Forresting Cole. And Claude passed away this past year. And so I did his funeral. And Claude and Forresting, just a couple who were alive, they were married 6 years when they died? When Forresting died with Alzheimer's, and just a live couple, they're just so fun. One day they're visiting us, and Claude said, well, yeah, we drive by your neighborhood all the time, because Forresting says, let's go see Paul in Virginia. This is when she had Alzheimer's, and he says, I know you won't be home, but we just drive by your house. And I said, oh, Forresting, they're not home, but you're home today, so we came. So we talked for a little while, and as they were leaving, Virginia was talking to Forresting upstairs, and I was talking to Claude. And Forresting had been with her daughter for a week, and so Claude was home and wasn't having to care for Forresting. And I said, Claude, I bet it was sure a relief not to have Forresting home this last week. And we're close friends, and it's the closest to taking my head off that he ever came. Not at all. How could you say that? He said, I missed every day. Why? Because they had developed a friendship over 60 more years of caring for each other. They're growing old really well together. I want to suggest they grew old intentionally. They didn't decide after 60 years of marriage, wow, we're going to die pretty soon. We better start liking each other. They built a relationship of intentionality.
And so we want to wrap it up by challenging you with the question, what are you doing to build into your marriage now a foundation that will sustain it for the long haul, that's going to take it to the end?
I was recently with my parents, who will celebrate their 64th anniversary this August 16th. My father has been on the journey of dementia for over 10 years now. He's a retired admiral in the Navy, and they raised 7 children together. They got married when they were 18 and 20. If they'd come to one of our marriage seminars, we would have told them not to do that, but the year was 1948, and they did that then. One of the most vivid memories I have of growing up as a child in that home, one of 7 kids, is that when my father was deployed, which was frequent during the Vietnam era, he was gone for 32 out of 36 months. He commanded a destroyer. He was on land duty in Da Nang. He had his ship in dry dock in San Francisco for 32 months. He was gone. But the memory that I have of my mom every single night when my father was deployed, as I went in to kiss her goodnight, it would be at the mahogany table that my parents had built together, so we had a big enough table for the 9 of us to sit around, was her sitting there with her Mead writing tablet, writing to my dad. She had a box of Mead envelopes that were numbered, that she numbered. And each night, after writing pages to my father, she would slip them into the pre-numbered envelope and drop that in the mail the next day. When my father was out at sea, the mail drop would only come once every 2 weeks. At the same time as my mom was doing that, my father was, wherever he was in the world, doing exactly the same thing. He was writing to my mom much shorter letters and putting them into a pre-numbered envelope and sending them off to the States for my mom. And mail day, let me just tell you, my mom would check that mailbox every day, and 13 days it would be empty. But on the 14th day, she would get this stack of letters, and she knew the order to read them in because they were numbered, and she would know if any of them were missing. And it was sort of like when mail day came, we just didn't bother her for a few hours as she just had this very sweet time with my father through letters. Every Sunday, we made a reel-to-reel tape to my dad, which he would get and send back, and he would send messages to all of us children, which were very short, and then spend the balance of it talking to my mom. All of those letters and tapes are in boxes in my parents' storage area now, with the instructions from my father to burn them before my mom dies, if she outlives him. I've already laid claim to them because of our work with marriage. I think it would be very helpful. We remains to be seen what's going to happen with those letters, but I've thought a lot about that discipline that my parents committed themselves to so that they would keep their marriage alive through many, many days of being apart. I recently asked my mom, how did you do that? I mean, I'm thinking, we only had 3 daughters, and when Paul was traveling, when I got all 3 kids in bed, it was like, whew, I would collapse. I'd grab my Good Housekeeping magazine or some other way of relaxing and enjoying myself, but I certainly wouldn't be thinking at that point of one more thing to do. And my mom said, oh, she said it was the best time of the day for me. She said, I felt like I was talking to your father every single night that I wrote him those letters. And I'm here to tell you that not one night passed that my mom did not write those letters. And I'm so inspired by that. I think in our world where we're so busy, where it's so easy in my mind to cheap out on the things that are long-lasting in order to do the things that are right in front of us, that are easiest, that are most convenient. And I think the biggest area it might show up in our generation is in investing in our marriages. There are so many other things for which we get accolades, for which we get paid, for which we get notoriety, for which we get encouraged from our culture. But not many people are standing on the sidelines of our marriage saying, prioritize this, make this count, give this your best. Keep learning about each other, keep acting on that knowledge, because your marriage relationship is probably one of the most significant parts of the legacy that you are going to leave when your life is over. And before we close, I just do want to just acknowledge that we understand divorce is a part of our world, that brokenness touches all of us, and that sometimes divorce is the lesser of two evils. We understand that. But there are just far too many of us that are robbing our marriages and paying things that are very, very temporal with the money we take. And so as we wrap up tonight, we just want to encourage you to consider, how are you building into the friendship of your marriage? Friendship is a really critical component of the marriage relationship that I think we sort of lose sight of when we get involved in raising children and in advancing careers and in making a living and all the rest. What are we doing to build into our friendship?
Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for this whole idea you had of marriage and relationships, for how good it is to be together. And our desire is that our relationship as husband and wife would not only be that which brings us joy, but we pray that it would be that which really reflects the glory of the Trinity, and that we live in such a way that people will be drawn to examine the gospel more fully. So we thank you for the gift of relationship and pray that you will help us increasingly to find joy in you and in each other. In Christ's name.